thanks again to all of you for all your phone calls and web clicks in our spring fundraising campaign here at WKAR. And if you haven't made a gift yet, it is not too late, but you will do so, please, online. Everybody who makes a pledge online by 7 p.m. tonight will be automatically entered to win a pair of tickets to 5 Broadway shows. This is Wharton Center's Broadway series for 2016-2017. Beautiful, the Carole King musical is one of them. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is another one. That sounds pretty mysterious. Use the Give Now button at WKAR.org by 7 p.m. tonight to be entered. And before the end of the hour, we will be announcing the winner of our Leading Edge Golf Gift Package. It's Current State on WKAR. Many thanks for joining us. Efforts are underway to improve operations at the state-run Grand Rapids Home for Veterans. In February, a Michigan auditor's report revealed shoddy practices, including the failure to monitor residents, understaffing, and improper dispensing of pharmaceuticals. In recent years, the state's outsourced nursing assistants at the facility to a private health service provider, J2S Group. Critics say the episode is more evidence that privatization is poor policy that doesn't work. Our next guest plays a lead role in upgrading operations at the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans. James Redford was appointed Michigan's interim director of Veterans Affairs shortly after the auditor's report. On Friday, I ran through a few of the audit's findings and asked what's happening to address them. For starters, the audit found the facility understaffed 81% of the time over 4 sampled months. I asked how that problem's being addressed.
What we're doing to address that is to use the J2S contractors in a more efficient and meaningful way, together with adding contract amendments to get the wage that we're paying to the staff at a more competitive rate with the market that now exists in Grand Rapids. We're also authorizing the contractor to utilize 2 other outside contractors to help supplement their staff, and we expect to be issuing in the relatively near future what's called an RFP, request for proposal, for potential bidders for the contract moving forward, because the contract it extends until September 30th of this year.
Well, given J2S's record here, is it your preference that another company get that contract?
What my preference is, Mr. Bayshore, is that any individual or organization who wants to provide quality services and to help serve really the greatest veterans we've got in our veterans' homes, that they apply. And we're welcoming everyone. It's an open process, and we're looking forward to, assuming that the RFP does go out, and that the final determination hasn't been made, but assuming it does, we're looking forward to anyone who's interested in being partners and providing care for our veterans to also to seek to participate in the RFP.
But I guess my point is, given what you know about J2S, would you prefer that another company get that contract?
It's not appropriate for me as the head of the agency, interim or otherwise, to comment on who I would prefer, because I frankly don't have a preference. What I prefer is that we have the best providers of services in the contractual partners that we have with our state. So I don't have a preference.
Now, surveillance video indicated that 43% of location checks, checking on residents, I guess, and 33% of fall alarm checks did not occur. And worse yet, the home's staff documented those as happening 100% of the time and 96% of the time, respectively. Those are alarming numbers. How do you address that?
Well, first, I agree with you that they're alarming and they're completely unacceptable. And I've been saying that since February 19th and continue to. The way we're addressing it is we are educating our staff. We are holding staff accountable. We are having more and more frequent and more thorough training. And we're making sure that individuals are correctly and accurately entering in the records what is actually taking place. Our staff have been notified that false record entries is a zero defect that will not be accepted and is the grounds for an immediate termination. We're implementing electronic medical record systems to bring more technology into the picture to better solve the problem and to accurately reflect what's taking place with our residents.
There was shoddy work done relating to medications dispensed to the residents there during a nearly two-year period. 39% of non-narcotic prescriptions were refilled either late or more than 5 days early. What needs to happen on that front?
What needs to happen and has happened is we've purchased what are called Pyxis machines, Mark. They are a device which you would probably see in most commercial or private nursing-type facilities, which will individually prepare the disbursement of medications for each member individually and have a tracking system in place in each of the wards of the facility. Those are on station now and are being implemented now.
I'm talking with Jim Redford, the interim director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. We're talking about the MVA's response to a scathing audit back in February by the state auditor. There were a host of other issues. We don't have time to get into all of them specifically. Let me just ask, what's the toughest single feature of this landscape to try to reform and why?
The toughest part, Mark, is just changing and empowering our staff, our employees, our team members, both volunteers, professionals, to make sure that they understand the 150% commitment each of us are required to have to take care of those who have worn the cloth for our nation each day. And it starts from every person at that home is responsible to provide quality care, leadership and care, whether you're the person who's handing out a tray of foods to one of these heroes or whether you're the person who happens to be the interim or director of the agency. So it's a team effort and it's leadership, and we're expecting every one of our staff, permanent, state, contract, or anyone who's with us to be part of that team veteran that's going to lead the way to make sure we make the appropriate improvements and care for these veterans appropriately.
Looking back on this, you must have some idea by now, I imagine, as to how this unfolded. What are your thoughts on that? How do breakdowns across these areas, how do they happen?
I have some assessments, but I'm not focusing on what happened in the past. What I'm focusing on and our team is focusing on is let's put in the mechanisms necessary, the leadership necessary, the resources necessary to fix the problems. And whatever the problems were in the past, it's not going to change it. So what we're focusing on is making sure that our veterans are getting the right care at the right time, at the right place, from the right caregiver.
Now, you're several months into this process. Is J2S a company that is capable of the reforms that are necessary?
With the work that they're doing, together with the modifications that have made to the contract, we're optimistic that we're going to be able to meet the requirements of staffing together with our professional staff to meet the needs for our members throughout the period of the contract.
What are your feelings about J2S? What kind of working relationship do you have with the people in that company that you have to work with here?
We've had multiple meetings, Mark, with them. I have personally, as well as my senior staff, our nursing staff, trying to address the issues. They are engaged and attempting to address the issues as well.
Do you feel like it's a good faith effort there? Does J2S concern you in any way? You feel they are capable, again, of the reforms that are necessary?
What I know is that when I have a conversation with a contractor, whether it's J2S or another outside contractor, and whether it's in this position or in other positions that I've had the privilege of serving either at the county level, the Navy level, or at the state level, it is my expectation that those who engage in a contractual relationship are going to fulfill the terms of it. We're going to have frank and candid discussions about what the requirements are, frank and candid discussions about any shortcomings that we identify, and identify areas of improvement and how we're going to improve. So it's my expectation, if you're going to choose to do business with either a public or a private entity, you're going to be able to fulfill the obligations that you've entered into.
This audit emboldened even further the critics of privatization of state services. Do you think the reforms that are necessary will be enough to change the minds of any of those critics. This is a serious divide of a divided opinion that we've had in our state over this.
I can't speak to what is going to change anyone's mind other than myself. I can't get inside another individual's head, obviously. What I do think is we have to look at all of the data, we have to look at all of the options, and we have to consider what's best when we're fulfilling our responsibilities of providing the services that we're required to either constitutionally or statutorily as parts of state government. And I think that we are fiscal stewards of finite financial resources, and we have to recognize that at the same time that we have to recognize we are also responsible to fulfill the duties of our offices. And sometimes that means private contracting is better. Sometimes it means maybe it's not, but it's something that has to be looked at and examined carefully in each situation.
I hope it's fair to ask if you've been how much of an advocate of privatization of state services you have been in the past. Is it a concept that you generally support?
I haven't been asked to advocate for it one way or the other, to be perfectly candid. I mean, I think I've looked at private contracts where they're appropriate. I've supported them. Where I think that they're not necessarily appropriate or advantageous, I suspect that I wouldn't have supported them. I'm having trouble thinking of more than a few examples where I've been asked to look at them.
But generally, would you say you're open to the notion of privatization of state services?
I'm open to those who have the responsibility of providing services as state officers of doing it in a complete manner, a fair manner, and an efficient manner. And it doesn't matter to me as much who's the person who's writing the paycheck. What matters is, are we delivering the services that we need for the individuals we have the privilege of serving? If it's a private contractor that can or does it better, then perhaps that's the best use of the finite resources. If it's a state-contracted state employee, then perhaps it's a state employee. I don't have a definitive position one way or the other.
I've been talking with James Redford, the interim director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. We're talking about the MVA's response thus far to a scathing audit back in February by the state auditor. Mr. Redford, thank you.
Thanks so much. I hope you have a great day.
It's Current State here on 90.5 FM, and I want to thank everyone who contributed to our spring fundraising campaign here in recent days. I hope right now you will consider joining the over 400 that called and clicked in recent days. You can use the Give Now button at WKAR.org by 7 p.m. tonight, and if you do that, you will be entered to win a pair of tickets to 5 shows in Wharton Center's Broadway series for the 2016-2017 season. WKAR.org. And again, thank you. Coming up on Current State, Touré is one of America's leading writers on subjects ranging from music to racial politics. Ahead of a visit to Grand Rapids this week, we have the first of a two-part talk with Touré today on Prince and his role in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee. That is on the way on Current State. It's almost hunting season, and no, I don't mean deer or pheasants or ducks. I mean morels. The spring mushroom has become a favorite of professional chefs, and chances are you'll see it making an appearance on some of your favorite farm-to-table restaurants soon. But you don't need to shell out $40 a pound or book a reservation at a fancy restaurant to enjoy some morels this spring. You just have to know what to look for and where. To tell us what and where that is, we welcome Sister Marie Copen, secretary for the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club and an amateur mycology enthusiast. Marie, welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
Starting out here, can you just describe what exactly a morel looks like?
Well, it's sort of like an ear of corn when you take the kernels out of it. It's got little pockets in it. That's the makeup of it. It's sort of like an ice cream cone turned upside down, but it's got little pockets in it. And they range in color from black, kind of a black finish on it, to white, to a yellow.
What do they taste like?
Oh, they taste delicious.
I'm not proud to admit it. I'm a native Michigander, but I don't think I've ever had a morel.
Oh, my. Oh, you poor thing.
I'm missing out on something special, huh?
I feel sorry for you. You better go to the grocery store and buy some dried ones and taste them.
I guess I should. When you're out looking for morels, how do you know you're looking in the right places?
Well, there is a fellow named Larry Lonick. Now, he's gone to his reward, and he wrote a book about morels, and he's got 4 pages single-spaced of where you can look for morels. And then at the very end, he says, morels are where you find them. But they do have affinity for certain trees because the base of the morel is sort of like a big root underground. You can't see it. And the root has kind of a partnership relationship with a certain species of trees because some people say there's 3 kinds of morels, white, black, and yellow, but the scientists have discovered maybe 47 or 50-some here in Michigan, and that would be, more tiny differences.
Hmm. I imagine the people who really take this seriously get pretty good at knowing where to go. Where in the state are morels, do they tend to be more abundant?
In areas where there's not much development, because we had a lot of areas where morels grow, and then all of a sudden there's houses or shopping malls or whatever put in them. Actually, we have a saying, you know, if I told you where I find morels, I would have to kill you.
Scary. Well,
everybody guards the secrets, but, you know, we have the state and national forests. Morels grow everywhere in Michigan. In fact, they grow all the way to Florida and even in California and Alaska.
Well, I've heard morels are especially abundant in woods that have recently seen fires, too. Is that true? And if so, why?
There's a certain species that has an affinity for certain types of pine trees. Now, 2 years ago, we had a fire burn in the Upper Peninsula, and I can't remember the exact location, but the DNR published it with pictures of the fire burning. So those in the know scrambled up there 1 year later, and they were all over. But it's a certain species related to a certain kind of pine tree. And don't ask me which, because I'd have to look it up.
Okay. Now, these mushrooms, you say some of them seem to have a light brown color, which seems that it's pretty easy to overlook a morel, I imagine, even maybe if they're right in front of you. How hard is it to train yourself to find a morel?
Well, that varies on the person. I call it getting your morel eyes every spring. I have to go out and kind of look at the ground because sometimes there's not very much green growing, and so the morel will look like the leftover material from the year before, this brownish.
Yeah.
And, they start out very small, and then they get bigger. And, of course, the bigger they get, the more the chances are somebody else will walk by and pick them.
Sister Marie Copen is the secretary for the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club, and we're talking about the morel hunting season, which is just getting underway. Now, not all mushrooms that you can find in the wild are safe to eat. Is this kind of foraging something that people should not do on their own? Should you have an expert showing you around?
Well, you either have to have an expert showing you around, or perhaps it has been in your family history, and your mom and dad or your grandparents will show you how. Either way, it is safe for morels, but I would not go out and just look without some help as a beginner. There is a false morel. Some people call it beefsteak. Genetically, it's not a true morel, but it has monomethylhydrazine, which is rocket fuel, in it. And it's debatable about how that affects your liver and other organs. Some people seem to eat it with no problem. Some people will get sick with a few bites. Tastes very, very good, I'm told, because I won't touch it after hearing a chemist talk about it. You can boil the rocket fuel off by putting the mushroom in water, but don't smell it. And what happens is when you eat that mushroom, your digestive enzymes mix with the flesh, and it returns to rocket fuel.
Good grief.
And also current research shows that there is a higher rate of cancer with people who eat those kinds of mushrooms.
Hmm. You are a nun with the Sisters of the Precious Blood and also a retired speech pathologist. How did you get interested in mycology and mushroom hunting?
Oh, it was a family affair. My great-grandmother and two of my grandmas and, well, grandparents, two fathers, came from Europe. One group lived at the base of the Tatra Mountains, which is the Polish Alps, and my great-grandmother took my dad out hunting in Genesee County, and so that's where he got started. And then when I was a little girl, I grew up in Genesee County in Flint, and so he took me out along the Flint River, and that's how I got started.
Well, are true morels found in Europe, or are they only found in North America?
They're found all over the world.
They are. Okay. Now, is it possible to find morels or other edible mushrooms in more urban areas like Flint?
Yes. In fact, you can buy kits, and you can grow them.
You can.
And if you came out in the wild and brought some home, you could disperse the spores in your backyard soil. And there's two trees here in Michigan that they like the most, and one is the ash tree. And, of course, the ash borer is taking care of that.
Yeah.
And the other is an elm tree. And I'm not sure the specific species of elms, but there's a relationship, a high one, with those two kinds of trees here. So if you have those trees in your backyard, in fact, I think one kit comes with nursery stock trees of the kind they like, or aspens, too, when they're small. But those kits are available online.
Hmm.
And some people have good luck with them, and some do not. And I think it's because of the kind of trees in their backyards or where they're trying to grow them.
Sister Marie Copen is secretary for the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club. Again, we're talking about morel, the morel hunting season, which is just getting started. You lead public hunts for the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club. Can you walk us through what one of these hunts looked like?
Well, I do most of my hunts in Isabella County, and I do them in relationship with the Chippewa Watershed Conservancy, with the County Park System, and with Central Michigan University within the Nethercutt Woods in Clare County, or just the city parks. And so we would gather at a designated parking lot or pavilion or whatever, and then I would give a talk, and in some cases a handout, describing what we're hunting, and actually the best mushroom selection is in the fall and late summer. So I would describe some things we're looking for, and then I would send people out or walk with them, depending on how the size of the group, and then set a time when we would come back, and then we put the mushrooms we found on a display table, like a picnic table, or a tarp on the ground or something, and check them all out.
You're saying morel season lasts until the fall?
No, the mushroom season lasts until the fall. There are probably up to 200 or 300 species of mushrooms in Michigan which you can eat. Now, it doesn't mean they taste good. They could taste like wood.
Mm-hmm.
But you could use them for survival purposes if you know what you're doing.
How long does morel season last?
Around here, probably till the middle of June.
What?
And it depends on if you're talking about the Upper Peninsula, because the season lasts longer there because it's colder, or are you talking about Toledo by the border of southern Michigan?
So it depends on your latitude, basically.
That's right, because I know Isabella County is like 1 week ahead of Genesee County in terms of growth of plants and everything.
Once people have some morels, what's your best advice for actually preparing them to eat? What's your favorite way to eat morel mushrooms?
My favorite way is very simple. I like to fry them in butter and then make some toast, butter the toast, and put the morels on top of the toast.
Is that a pretty common way? Do a lot of people eat them that way?
You know, I never asked. But I know some people do elaborate recipes. They have a stew. Oh, we had a potluck last Sunday at the Farmington Library and with our club meeting, annual meeting. And a friend of mine, the president of the club, Antoine, he prepared salmon with a mushroom sauce, with morels, with some kind of baked potatoes on the side, little or baked with a sauce on them, not a baked potato, you know. And that was so delicious, fresh. And others had them in casseroles, and the list is endless, and you can get recipes online.
Sister Marie Copen is the secretary for the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club. We've been talking about the morel mushroom season. Marie, thank you for joining us today. Good luck. Good luck this season.
Thank you so much.
And coming up on Current State, now that spring has sprung, you can put away the skis, but keep the poles. WKAR's Peter Wharf takes a hike on the Red Cedar with certified Nordic walking instructor Eric Ederer to explore the new total body low impact workout. That and more after the break. Thanks again to the more than 400 WKAR supporters who together donated more than $55,000 to WKAR in 4 days. It's still not too late to support radio you enjoy and rely on and be entered to win a pair of tickets to 5 Wharton Center Broadway series shows in the 2016-2017 season. Just use the Give Now button at WKAR.org by 7 p.m. tonight. To be entered, also before the end of the hour here, we will announce the winner of our Leading Edge Golf gift package that's a part of our spring fundraising campaign. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. Touré is one of those rare writers who's not only gifted but also widely read in more than one field. Much of his early writing was done on topics related to music. He's also written extensively on matters of race, most notably with his 2011 book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? Now, you may have seen him on television. He was a co-host of the now-defunct MSNBC program, The Cycle. On Thursday, he'll be part of a program called Identity and Bias, Impact on Individuals and Institutions. That is a program in Grand Rapids. Current State Scott Pohl recently spoke with Touré, and he's here with more. We're going to hear from Touré twice on the show this week, Scott.
That's right, Mark. We had a lengthy conversation on the topics closest to his heart. I must say that by way of introduction, I met Touré in January while I was at the International Blues Challenge in Memphis. He was at a program featuring female blues artists, talking with people for an upcoming story on women in the blues for Smithsonian Magazine. I can't wait to see what he has to say about that. Since music was our introduction, I wanted music to be the first part of this two-part interview. His most recent book, I Would Die for You, is about one of my favorite performers, Prince. Touré calls Prince one of the most extraordinary artists of our times.
That book began out of the previous book when I interviewed Skip Gates for my book about blackness. At the end of the conversation, he said, you know, well, why don't you come back next year and, you know, you'd be part of our lecture series where, you know, somebody does 3 lectures on something, some aspect of culture. So I was like, okay, you know, what would I like to do that I could spend, you know, a year or two focused on? And like, you know, if you give yourself a 2-year project, you know, in the realm of culture, you want to make sure that you're not going to be sick of that thing by the end of the, you know, I mean, like that would be really bad. Like if you wrote a book on the Brady Bunch and by the end of the, you know, the book's about to come out and they're asking you for edits and you're like, I can't stand these people. I wish they would all explode, you know? and Prince was something that I was like, I could listen to that music and, you know, sort of dig deeper into that guy and what he's all about for, you know, a very long time. And I spent a lot of time really like sifting through that music with like a microscope, and musicologists, and deconstructing it with me for me. And I love the music, his music, and you know, it's not old or for me or anything like that.
You're on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee, and you've written extensively for many years about music and musicians. Some notable rockers like Gene Simmons have decried rap and hip-hop and say that acts like N.W.A. don't belong in the Hall of Fame. They were just inducted into the Hall. Lots of really notable artists like Tupac Shakur are going to become eligible for the Hall in the next few years. What's your perspective on membership in the Hall, nominating artists to the Hall? Can you shed some light on that, please?
Well, you know, there's definitely some argument and debate within that group of what does rock and roll mean? And I think there you get the schism where some of us are like, of course, Run DMC and Tupac and N.W.A. should go in, and others who are like, where's the guitars? And, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has honored a certain kind of hip-hop act, Public Enemy, in N.W.A.'s in, but De La Soul, KRS-One, Rakim are not. You know, Run DMC is in, but Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Flash are not, right? The sort of core of the pioneer class. So, you know, this is extremely spotty record. You know, I mean, if you look at like who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it doesn't come close to telling the history of hip hop. Because certain sorts of groups that were loud and abrasive and had the sort of more traditional rock and roll energy to them, I think, and had some more, well, yeah, those sort of groups are being rewarded and other groups are not. I mean, you know, the group of people who vote on such things is, you know, overwhelmingly white. They're mostly older than me. They're overwhelmingly male. A lot of them are not understanding of hip hop and they're not voting for hip hop. And there should be more of an effort to change the voting body. So you're moving into, historically, you're moving into a very fertile period for hip hop. Is Snoop going to get in? Is Tupac going to get in? You know, Biggie is coming up. Jay-Z is coming up very soon. You know, I mean, like, there'll be others. You know, Wu-Tang is coming up very soon. You know, I'm talking about in the next 2-3 years. You know, there are others who are just escaping me at this second, but I mean, still Rakim, KRS-One, De La Soul, not in. You know, it gets very difficult. People will start to really notice, like, wow, there's a large group of people who make up hip hop history who are not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And why is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ignoring these sort of people? And ultimately, it only goes to damaging the credibility of a really important, valuable organization. I mean, you know, like, I've been to that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame building. It's great. It's beautiful. It's a fun museum visit. If you're in Cleveland, or, you know, absolutely go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's, you know, if you care at all about music, you'll definitely enjoy it. You know, and the sort of people who they're inducting have to be right. And, you know, they're not moving in the right direction on hip hop. And I don't know if they will in time to keep it from that, like, you know, embarrassed again. You know, they end up getting embarrassed behind, where's so-and-so? Where's this one? Where's that one? I mean, like, you know, if people really people care about music really stopped and thought about how, you know, Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash and Kool Herc are not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that would be like, that's insane. Voters are explicitly told that rock and roll is meant to be understood as broadly as possible. It's not supposed to be a cudgel where you're like, well, you know, we compare you to the Rolling Stones, you know, or Led Zeppelin. And if you're not like them, then, you know, you don't like, no, that's not how it's supposed to be. You know, there, you know, we put in all sorts of groups and, you know, but I mean, you know, yeah, hip hop's not the only group that's complaining.
Author and commentator Touré will be part of Forum 2016 in Grand Rapids at DeVos Place on April 21st. It's sponsored by Partners for a Racism-Free Community in Grand Rapids. Touré, thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And tomorrow, Scott's conversation with Touré will turn to an examination of racial politics in the 2016 presidential campaign. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, Eric Ederer instructs mid-Michiganders in techniques of Nordic walking. The Scandinavian import activity is an outdoor exercise that provides a total body, low-impact workout. The Harris Nature Center in Meridian Township will hold a Nordic walking instruction session this Saturday, April 23rd. That's at 1:30 p.m. As a preview, WKAR's Peter Worf meets with Eric Ederer on the MSU campus for a discussion and a demonstration.
Nordic walking is a type of either athletic or rehabilitative walking done with a special type of pole which was invented in Finland back in 1997. And these poles make it very easy to walk on land or else walk on pavement with these poles.
When did you first get into it?
It's sort of an odd story. I was surfing on the web and there was a news site which had only happy news. And so Nordic walking was featured as a happy news news story.
Why was that?
I guess that's because it showed a bunch of people having a good time.
Do you have a good time when you Nordic walk?
I definitely have a good time when I Nordic walk, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about where Nordic walking comes from. You say it comes from Finland. Can you give me some information about sort of the development and the history?
It started in Finland in 1997. It was originally designed as training for cross-country skiers on the off-season, but then people saw its sports potential and rehabilitative potential, and then sort of took off from there. It's very popular in Europe. Nordic walking is done almost anywhere. You can, anywhere where you can walk, you can Nordic walk. And so it's a very popular way to get outdoors, get exercise, and also to exercise your arms too and get a better exercise than just walking by itself.
Tell me about the technique involved and some of the things that you'll be talking about when you give this instruction.
There'll be instruction on a hand technique, which is probably one of the most challenging things about it, is that the way you use your hands in Nordic walking with the poles is very specialized and requires some explanation. There is a type of pole called bungee pump pole, which is designed for rehabilitation and is a bit easier to use.
Eric, can we walk around a little bit and I'll sort of follow you, try and keep up with you? As we met today, you were hiking along the path along the Red Cedar River and you were going at a pretty good clip. So I'll try and keep up as maybe you demonstrate some of the techniques.
Okay.
Okay, we'll grab our poles here. And you can do this, I guess, on a paved surface. You were right here on the walkway above the Red Cedar. Do you typically do this paved surfaces, trails, on grass?
All of the above.
All of the above. Okay. Describe these poles that you have here. They look quite a bit like ski poles, but they're a little different.
Yeah, these poles are from Leki. The most interesting thing about them is that the bottom is adapted to be used on pavement, and also the hand grips are specialized in order to enable walking.
You're putting on kind of a Velcro-attached strap on each wrist. And then, like you say, on the bottom, you don't have sort of the pointed ends that you would with downhill or cross-country ski poles. They're kind of a diagonal bottom that's sort of look like, almost like a rubberized grip.
The bottom part comes off, and underneath is a steel point which can be used for trails and stuff like that.
Gotcha. Okay, well, can you show us how you use the poles and work them into your exercise and kind of describe it as we go along, maybe?
Well, okay, I'll try. Okay. You use one pole, if you put your right foot forward, you put the left pole forward like you do in cross-country skiing, and then you rotate, and it's just like this. The other thing is that the hand grips grips the pole and then releases, so it sort of has a butterfly effect with the hand. The walking is done, you usually take big steps with Nordic walking, and that's because Nordic walking reduces your weight by 30%, so there's with regard to the amount of pressure it creates on the knees, and so it's a lot easier to walk in big steps with Nordic walking.
You look like you have a very relaxed hand grip on those poles.
It's both relaxed and intense at times.
And then would this be sort of a beginning pace here, kind of how you would start people off?
This is a beginning pace, yes. And then as you progress, you get faster and a little bit faster. It's even possible to do Nordic walking with running too.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Do you do that?
No, I don't do that very often. I sprint once in a while, but not on a regular basis.
Take us up to a little greater intensity that you might like to work up to for a more strenuous workout. That's a pretty good clip. That's a faster walk than I would say most people.
Yeah. It's at this rate we're in between running and walking actually.
What do you hope to build up to? Is there a sort of a standard that you measure to, a tempo or something like that?
I think it's just whatever you're comfortable with. And you can do interval training on Nordic walking like you do with running. Right. And you just build and build and see where it goes.
What will you be doing with folks at the Harris Nature Center coming up on the weekend?
I'll be giving them an overview of Nordic walking, and we'll do some techniques and we'll try out some poles. There'll be travel poles there, which are special poles for traveling with Nordic walking. And there'll be some of the rehabilitative bungee pump poles there for people that want to Nordic walk with the greatest ease possible for rehabilitative purposes.
So Eric, after you got into it, what did you find that you liked most about Nordic walking?
I liked being outdoors, getting the total body workout, and sometimes just having the wind in my face.
Yeah. Well, we sure have that today on this first day of spring, as people can probably hear on the microphone very well right now, because I don't have a windscreen. not a very good move on a radio producer's part. Are you into any other kind of sports or sort of aerobic activities, or are you a skier, or a cross-country skier?
I cross-country ski. I'm a yoga instructor. And I lift weights, and I do ballroom dancing.
You stay fit and busy.
Yeah. I cross-train.
Yeah, for sure. Eric Ederer will be instructing you on Nordic walking at the Harris Nature Center coming up this weekend. Eric, once again, thanks very much.
Thanks.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Perfect for the first day of spring.
Perfect. Let's keep moving and stay warm.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks again for all of your phone calls and clicks here the last few days in our spring fundraising campaign at WKAR. It's not too late to make a gift online, and indeed, if you do that before 7 p.m., you will be automatically entered to win a pair of tickets to 5 Broadway shows that are a part of Wharton's Broadway series this coming season. Cabaret, Fun Home, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Use the Give Now button at WKAR.org by 7 p.m. tonight to be entered, and we wish everybody luck. Well, the Detroit Pistons lost a thriller to the Cleveland Cavaliers to open their playoff series, while the Red Wings dropped their second in a row to the Tampa Bay Lightning. This weekend, not a good postseason start for the Motown teams, but one Michigan State basketballer just hit the big time. Current Sports, Al Martin sorts it out here for us on Monday morning. How are you, Al?
How are you doing, Mark?
I am well, thank you. A thriller yesterday in Cleveland. Two teams neck and neck. What made the difference?
Well, I think it's a combination of a few things here, Mark. First off, even though the Pistons fell in game 1-2 Cleveland, this is a series, of course, in which they are significant underdogs. I mean, this is a 1-8 seed. But the Pistons, I mean, what a valiant effort to come out and to compete against the number one team in the East and push them to the wire here. And I really thought, you know, when looking at the first half, Mark. First off, you have to call out Marcus Morris, who was absolutely fantastic. In the first half, he scored 19 points. He was 3 of 4 from three-point range. And for the team combined, they shot actually 62% from the three-point line, Mark.
Whoa.
10 of 16. Unbelievable, right? And, you know, you look at Marcus Morris's production in that first half, 19 points. Mark, he finished with 20 points, just 1 point in the second half. Now, a lot of that, of course, had to do with the big three. LeBron James, Kevin Love, and Kyrie Irving were absolutely spectacular. And the Pistons defensively, Mark, could not slow those individuals down. But I have two stats here. The Cavs were able to convert 12 Piston turnovers into 19 points. There were multiple times in which the Pistons just kind of shot themselves in their own foot, gave the ball up, and the Cavs were able to convert on opportunities on the other end of the floor. And also, the Cavs were also able to convert 12 offensive rebounds into 20 second chance points. And that's glaring because the franchise player for the Red, White, and Royal Blue is Andre Drummond. I thought Andre Drummond in this game was way too quiet. He didn't need to do much in that first half because, again, the Pistons shot the lights out the ball. But when he needed to get big rebounds and really put some pressure on those that big front, specifically Kevin Love, Andre Drummond failed in that regard. So I think a target's on the back of Andre Drummond, Mark.
Let's switch gears to hockey. The Red Wings fell behind the Tampa Bay Lightning 2-0 to start the playoffs, but we bounced back with a 2-0 victory last night. What pulled it together last night?
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff Blashill making the coaching decision to actually start Peter Mrazek instead of Jimmy Howard. I thought that was gutsy. I thought it was risky. Because whenever you make a move that early in the series, it can certainly backfire on you and kind of evoke really a notion of panic or desperation. Mm-hmm. But Mrazek was fantastic. He had 16 saves en route to his third NHL career shutout. And Mrazek, I mean, he last started, Mark, on March 29th at Montreal and was really shaky down the stretch, which allowed Howard to kind of take over that role. So I thought that was key. And just the Wings being more aggressive than they had been in those first two games. I thought they were able to get in front of the net and get a lot of shots on Ben Bishop, and it paid dividends in the end.
Game four tomorrow night at the Joe Louis Arena. Let's get back to basketball just a little bit here because MSU basketball player Jasmine Hines just signed with the WNBA Los Angeles Sparks. What was it that so impressed L.A.?
Well, I think when you evaluate the career of Jasmine Hines, Mark, I mean, first off, you know, physically, you know, she's so intimidating because she's just so big. You know, 6'3". You know, she's got a lot of girth, a lot of muscle. I mean, her calf muscles, oh, my goodness. I don't know if you've ever seen Jasmine Hines in person, Mark, but she is physically intimidating when she's out there. Mm. So her size, and size is so valued no matter what level of basketball you're talking about, Mark. So I think that's something to turn the heads of those within the Sparks organization. And she's so competitive. She's so competitive, Mark. She wants to win. She's got polished footwork. She's got the fundamentals down. And we saw, I mean, her last game in a Spartan uniform at the Breslin Center. I mean, she had a career-high 36 points against Ohio State, and that's something that is a glaring stamp as to the way she played throughout her entire career. I think she's going to be a force for L.A.
And she joins some other Big Ten players.
She does. She actually joins Jantel Lavender from Ohio State and Christy Tolliver from Maryland, and also even a Detroit native in Crystal Bradford who balled out at Central Michigan University.
Now, Spartan football held its second scrimmage of the spring, concluding with a, well, explain these spring games here. They are a different animal. Can you help us understand what happened?
Well, first off, Mark, they barely let anything out the box. So for the media trying to analyze a spring game or spring scrimmage, I should say, because this was the second spring scrimmage,
right.
It's really tough. They don't give you any stats, and you have to just really dive in and really dissect the quotes that you get from Mark D'Antonio.
Yeah.
But the defense has now won both scrimmages. And Mark D'Antonio did call out one individual. Linebacker John Reschke has had a great camp thus far. So I don't know how much you can divert from it, but the defense looks pretty good right now, Mark.
We want to thank Al Martin, host of Current Sports on WKAR Radio and Television. More sports with Al this afternoon at 1 o'clock on AM 870. Also, Current Sports on WKAR TV every Thursday night at 10:30. You got a guest lined up for Thursday?
Yes, we have MSU women's basketball player Brandi Agee will be in studio with me on Wednesday.
Very good. Al Martin, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank everyone who has clicked at WKAR.org today to contribute here after our spring fundraising campaign. If you get make your contribution by 7 p.m. tonight, you will be eligible for some tickets to five different shows at part of Wharton Center's Broadway series here in 2016-2017. It's also a pleasure to announce the winner of our Leading Edge Golf Gift Package. Everybody who contributed on Friday was automatically eligible for this. And this is a full bag and putter fitting with a master club fitter, as well as a gift basket of golf essentials courtesy of Leading Edge Golf. Congratulations, Alan Levine of West Bloomfield. Alan, a member of our staff, will be contacting you with further information regarding your prize. That's our program for today. More of Scott Pohl's conversation tomorrow with Touré. Moving on from music, we'll turn to an examination of racial politics and the 2016 presidential campaign. And we've got part two of current state producers Jamie Paisley's interview with Lansing native Lisa Crone, whose musical Fun Home won 5 Tony Awards in 2015. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Hope to see you Tuesday. It's Current State on WKAR.